my favorite subject, and the things that led me to here. But first of all, I'd like to say that I live in Santa Monica, and I have a home group in Santa Monica. It's called the As Outlined in the Book group, and it meets every Tuesday at 7:30 in Santa Monica, and we have five different formats. Right? One's not good enough, and each format's a different meeting. I also have another home group, one that's just started a couple years ago. It's a book study, and it's on Thursday night, and the name of that meeting is the Thursday Night Step Study. Book study. Not very creative, but it certainly tells you what it is. And I like to refer to that meeting as Full Contact AA, because crosstalk's allowed and encouraged, questions are allowed, and debate is allowed. Right? And it used to happen more at Tuesday, but now it happens, you see it more at the Thursday night meeting, where you see people actually get up and just leave because it freaks them out. Because some people don't feel safe in a meeting like that, where you know if you say something wrong, people will ask you a question about it. And it's actually in the format that that the meeting is not for general sharing, and that it goes something like, and I can't remember it all, but we don't like to stop you in the middle of your share if you don't stay focused on the paragraph, the context of the paragraph that we're reading, but we will. Right? And we just read a paragraph and beat it to death. You know, and sometimes the topic of the meeting is one paragraph. And that's become my favorite meeting, really. So if you're ever in Santa Monica on a Tuesday or Thursday. I'd like to start off pretty much where this all began for me, and that was really when I was a teenager. When I was about 15, I was still riding my bicycle up and down Venice Beach. And as I creeped up to 15 and a half, I got a learner's permit, got a little motorcycle, and I started hanging around at this gas station. And at this gas station, I had a whole bunch of people hanging around there. If you hung out there like on a Friday night, 20, 30, 40 people would just drive through, just people, regulars to the gas station, just to see what people are doing. And they rented U-Haul trucks there. And here we are, it was the late 60s. I was a teenager. I had just months away from just riding my little bicycle around the beach where I grew up. And now I had all these people to hang out with. And every day what we did was walk to the liquor store and hang out outside and wait for someone to buy us some beer. And I don't know why, but the thing was to get a quart and a can of Colt 45. Why a quart and a can? I don't know. That's what we did for a long time. And what I found was that if you pour some tequila into the beer, you don't have to drink quite as much beer. Right? Early on, I got a taste for hard liquor, right? And because I just really liked what it did for me. Right? And there was a lot of drugs back in the late 60s, early 70s. Practically everything came through the gas station because there were so many people that whatever anybody had, they would buy it in bulk because they could drive it through this gas station and pass it around to all the friends. And the gas station rented U-Hauls. So we'd we go inside these U-Hauls and just drink and do drugs and party. And we did it practically every day, pretty much every day. So I did go to school. I did go to high school. I regularly went to the first class. And then for some reason, just that was it for me. It happened to be photography, and I liked that. And then I'd also go to another high school. I went to two high schools. One I was enrolled in, and the other one all my friends were at. And I had this car, eventually, that had this... I put an air horn on it. And it had a kind of a distinguishable sound to it. And I would drive by this high school in Culver City, and I'd honk this horn, and my friends would hop the fence, and we'd just go out and hang out at the beach and drink. And it started off really well. And I remember thinking, what more could they possibly teach me that I would need to know anyway? Right? And I had friends. I had a little business going. I was buying clothes down in downtown LA and taking them out to swap meets to sell them, factory seconds with little holes in them. And I was working on weekends and partying during the week. I set up my life really basically so that I could do whatever I wanted to do. And my life kind of continued like that. I always kind of set up the things around my life so I could continue to live the way I wanted to live. I don't have the kind of story where I got fired from a lot of jobs because I never really wanted to put myself in a position where I had to be accountable to anybody else. I always started these little businesses and, you know, I kept myself in a situation that I could always do what I wanted to do. And I don't know that I consciously did that, but looking back, I see that there was a particular way of life that I wanted to live. And it involved drinking whenever I wanted to drink and doing drugs whenever I wanted to do drugs. The drug thing kind of came and gone. I'm not one that would say that I'm powerless over everything. I wouldn't even say that at that time I was even powerless. Because I'm really not powerless till I try to do something and fail. Right? Because as long as was drinking the way I wanted to drink and living the way I wanted to live, whatever was going on around that, I wouldn't be able to see any powerlessness because I was pulling off what I set out to do, right? And in that situation, there was a whole lot of drugs that came into the picture. Acid, mescaline, a lot of marijuana. You know, it was pretty consistent the way that it would unfold. You know, one day my stepbrother, who also was at the gas station, came up to me and he says, "Dan, you're starting sentences and not finishing them." Right? And I realized that I'm just smoking way too much pot. Right? So I stopped because I didn't like the idea of being out of control. And it was kind of like that consistently with the different drugs. You know, I do a bunch of LSD for a while and then stop. I hated PCP, and I, for some reason I kept doing it. I don't know why, but eventually I just stopped. Developed a really nice relationship with cocaine that lasted a while. But even that eventually came to the point where I stopped it. But alcohol just was kind of dependable, I guess you'd call it. It always seemed to work. And there was so much different directions you can go. I remember getting really sick on vodka and saying, well, I'm going to stay away from vodka and just stick to whiskey, because whiskey's never done that to me. And it was funny how I had this whole idea that there were certain drinks that were better for certain occasions, right? Naturally, you know, rum would be nice if you're on a date and you want to get romantic. some daiquiris or something. You know, beer is kind of like water, right? If you're thirsty, right? But if you really want to get serious and you're hanging out with the guys, whiskey's the way to go. Right? Now, if you're going to a party and you know that you're either going to, like, make love or fight, right? Then tequila, there was the only choice, right? You know, because that allowed you to be aggressive any direction you wanted to go. Now, whether I was any less aggressive on whiskey than I was on tequila, I don't know. But I had this idea in my head that I was in complete control of my liquor. Right? But it was easy to have that kind of idea because I was, as I said, living the way I wanted to live, doing the things I wanted to do, and having fun. Thought I was going to drink forever. I can never really realized it. But, you know, in the book, Bill talks about feeling like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And if you're not really, if you don't know the story, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Mary Riley, but it was the maid's perspective of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Right? And it was interesting what he said. He said, when confronted with the question of why does he continue to do what he's, to take the serum that makes him, it turns him into Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. Because Dr. Jekyll was meek and quiet and kind of nerdy, right? Mr. Hyde was a womanizer. He was aggressive. He was macho. So when he talks about the idea that he was a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I completely relate to that because alcohol turned me into Mr. Hyde. He says in the movie, he says, I don't know, I just seem to like that personality better. Right? And I realized that was me. There was a part of Dan that I liked better with alcohol. With alcohol, I thought I could do more. I thought I was a better lover. I thought I was a better dancer. Whether that was true, you'd have to ask somebody else because I wouldn't have known. Right? But I liked Dan better with alcohol than without it. Right? I thought that it gave me the personality that I should have. I wouldn't say that I gave it that much thought at the time. I just did it. Because it became such a big part of my life. It was like breathing. I drank. And if you decided that you couldn't drink anymore, like we were drinking, I don't know if you can relate to this, if you had you got your drinking buddies and you got that one guy that says, you know, I can't keep up with you guys. I'm doing school, I'm doing the girlfriend, you know. And they just kind of stop drinking. And eventually they don't want to hang around you because while they're not drinking, they don't really have a lot to say to you. Right? You know, but I had a certain idea about those people. Right? It was either they were weak, right, or they were bores. Right? They just didn't, you know, it just, for some reason, eventually they would just fall away because they probably, I don't know if you were ever now sober hanging around people that are drinking, you know, you probably know what they were going through, but I didn't see it because to me, I couldn't see a life any other way without alcohol. So I told you I had this little business. I was selling clothing and swap meets, and eventually I got into the poster business early on, and I started selling those at swap meets. And I was working out of these little garages. And in Santa Monica, I had a few garages going, and cutting metal frames and cutting oak frames, and oak is a hardwood, and I went out and I bought these double-cutting miter saws. Now, I don't know if you've ever cut oak, but it's really noisy. All right, now picture this. Santa Monica's got a lot of apartment buildings, and here's my little garage. Got this big pneumatic, computer-controlled pneumatic double-cutting miter saw, cutting oak from, like, the guys like to start at 7 in the morning. It's apartment buildings all around. Okay, well, they didn't put up with it too long. Santa Monica got down on me and eventually said, you know, you got to get this thing into a commercial area. They shut me down. So I got pushed into this commercial area out in Gardena. And I met a guy named Jose there in Gardena. Jose was a good guy. And we got into a lot of, I don't want to say trouble together. We didn't really get in trouble, but we did a lot of stuff, a lot of drinking, smoked a lot of crack, and ended up in a lot of areas around that, you know, like South Central LA and just outside of Watts, areas that we shouldn't have been in. And I remember there was a couple different times I remember telling Jose, he says, you know, Jose, I got to stop smoking this crack. This is really affecting my work and my life. And he says, okay, well, we'll just drink today, right? And that seemed like the obvious solution, right? I couldn't see that alcohol, the thing that was so important to me, could possibly be bad. Right? I couldn't see that I was out of control. Right? Let me rephrase it this way. I knew that I could get out of control with it, but I didn't know that I could never get out of control with it, if you understand what I mean by that. The idea that was there that if I really, really wanted to, I could control it, but obviously I don't. The idea that there was no control, as long as I liked the way things were going, you know, that as long as I was keeping things together around that, it seemed okay. I mean, I still had the little business going, and I had got married by this point, things looked okay, and I was having fun still. So still, there's no powerlessness in my life, really. I mean, because it seemed like the idea that if I could just say, well, I don't want to smoke crack today, I'm just going to drink, and that sounded okay, then that sounded okay, right? If that makes any sense. Because I never really tried to stop. And that really can hang people up when they look back at their drinking. Right? People saying that, well, I'm addicted to everything. Right? Just because I did everything doesn't mean I was addicted to it. Right? Just because I did everything doesn't mean I was going to eventually be powerless over it. Because right? most of the things that came into my life, eventually I got bored with it and stopped. That's power. And the more that I could control the things around me, I controlled my work life. I pretty much controlled my home life, because she pretty much went along with whatever I said, even though there was many nights where I didn't even come home because I had to sleep in my office because I couldn't make it home. And I seemed to be controlling the drug, so I thought that I was in control of everything. But in the back of my mind, I knew that things should be better, right? But it wasn't my fault. If she would have stopped nagging the way she was nagging, then the marriage would be better. Right? If the customers that I was dealing with would just be more faithful to me and not use more than one person for their stuff. If they'd pay me on time, right? I was still under the idea that there was, that I was holding things up, but people were still getting in my way. If they would only, it was their fault that the condition of my life was, had dark spots. Never once did I focus on the idea that maybe if I wasn't drinking so much and using so many drugs, that I would have worked a lot harder at building this business and kept money coming in. Right? I couldn't put it all together. Still not powerless because I didn't see it, never tried to stop. There was as I said, that there was a lot of cocaine in my story. I was smoking crack and shooting cocaine. Right. Again, I want to, in case I forget to say it, I came to a point where I stopped that before I came to AA and was just drinking. But I was certainly out of control with the cocaine. I was shooting cocaine, smoking crack, and the wife didn't seem to catch on to that. She really trusted me. And I think for the most part, I was pretty trustworthy, except for that area. And I never really cheated. I shouldn't say never really. I never cheated on her or anything. All the times that I didn't come home, it was because I was in my office. Because I couldn't make it home, or I didn't want her to see me like that. And, there was times when I was forced to drink and use at home only because I was gone for so many times. I remember making mixed drinks for her and myself. And I'd, strawberry margaritas, I remember, was one thing. And I remember taking a couple sips and just looking at me like, why so much tequila? But she wouldn't say it. She just wouldn't drink much of it. So most of the picture was there for me. She didn't really know about the drugs so much. There was times when she'd be sitting on the couch next to me dozing off, and I'd be on, I had my favorite, I see there's some over here, lazy boy chairs with the things that come up. I don't know why women hate those things, but guys love them. I don't know what the thing is about that, but I had this lazy boy chair that was just great. I had a blanket over me, and I would shoot cocaine underneath the blanket with her next to me. And, it was all because there's only so much time you could spend in the bathroom without them wondering that you've got some kind of sexual disorder, right? And there was times that I did spend a lot of time in the bathroom because there was the crack and the, And I think that the closest I ever came to getting caught had nothing to do with what I did in front of her. See, I had this really intelligent cat. Really intelligent. When it was a little kitten, we'd sit and play ball. I'd hit the ball to it, and it would knock it back to me. And we'd do this, and my wife would look at me and says, "It's just a coincidence. He's just hitting it, and it just happens to be going to you." And I says, "No, it's like we do it all night, back and forth." And then I taught it to sit, lay down, roll over, and then she just didn't know what to say. But it was an incredible cat. There was the one time that I had this stack of the filled syringes underneath the lazy boy chair. He actually grabbed a full syringe of cocaine and ran across the front room with it. And I had to try to catch him before she saw it. Which I caught at that time. It was the crack pipe that he picked up in his mouth and actually handed it to her. He fetched too. So he would get a ball and put it in your hand. He picked up a crack pipe and actually put it in her hand. And she comes to me and she goes, "What's this?" And I blamed it on my friend Jose that I mentioned about. She didn't like him anyway. And I said, "Oh, that's his pot pipe. He was here earlier. He left it here." And again, she trusted me. And so, sometimes I forget to mention it, so I'd like to just mention it. Jose never quite bought the whole program. A few years ago, his mother tells me the story, how he came in, they had dinner, and he smiled, he offered to do the dishes, and just went outside to have a cigarette like he usually does in the garage. And they were laying in bed, and they were saying, "Where's Jose?" And the father went into the garage to find Jose hanging by his belt from a hook in a rafter by his, this belt around his neck. And, he just never could get sober. And I don't think that he couldn't, but he just never bought the whole program. And a lot of times I forget to say that. And I feel really bad about that because he was so close to a solution and just never, just never did what some people have to do. But so the I always came up with good excuses to continue, good reasons to live the way I was living to my wife. Why I was staying, why I was sleeping in my office sometimes, and why I was why we were always having trouble with money, and why things just weren't seeming to come together. But she actually, it got harder and harder for her to live like that because she didn't really know why her life had become the way it was. Because when we got married, she thought I had a lot of potential, and I've never been short of people that thought I had a lot of potential in my life. But I don't know, but something wasn't right, and she didn't understand it, and she was getting more and more uncomfortable, and the more uncomfortable she got, the harder she was to get along with. You know, and naturally, the more she got like that, the more I thought, if she wasn't in my life, then I wouldn't be having so much trouble with my life. So I kicked her out. I kicked her out. I says, if you're not happy, get out of here. And because I really thought that, you know, it's the stuff that's around me. If I could only arrange the life around me how it needs to be, then I can enjoy my life again. But what happened after that is you know, I'd progressed with the drinking pretty far, and pretty much all the other drugs, including pot, was completely out of my life. It was just cocaine and alcohol. And she had left. I mean, I had thrown her out. And I remember sitting on my couch alone, TV off, just thinking, what happened to my life? You know, and this was about 1987. 2 years before I got sober. You know, I looked around my life, and the wife was gone. The business was closed down because I couldn't keep up the payments and, on the rent and the employees and all the stuff that went along with that. And, you know, looked around my life, and I thought, you know, something has to change. And I stopped the drugs altogether, and I made some decisions how I was going to use and how I was going to drink. And that's when things started to change for me, because now I'm starting to make some decisions on how I wanted to live, right, differently. And that way of life meant cutting back on the drinking and cutting back on the drugs. And then I started to see the failure of my ability to do that. You know, and I'd go kind of in and out of how I looked at my life, and sometimes I didn't care, and sometimes I cared more. But I started to see that something wasn't right, and the insane idea that came to my mind is, well, I've just been drinking and using so much that I've gotten used to it, and I've just gotten used to it, and I got to double up on what I've been doing. So I got a bottle of whiskey, a bunch of crack, and a bunch of cocaine to shoot, and I did it all at once. Right. Next thing I know, I'm face down on the ground, looking down at my body, my back on the ceiling. And I later read some stuff on near-death experiences, and it described it perfectly. Right. And, you know, but that wasn't enough to stop me. I did stop doing the drugs completely, because I figured if I just stopped and just drink, then I would pull my life back together and control everything. And so now I'm starting to make some decisions on how I'm going to drink. Right? And I do the thing where I go to bed and say, okay, tomorrow I'm not going to drink. And then before I even open my eyes in the morning, the first thought that comes to my mind is when am I going to start drinking now? Or where am I going to get the money to drink? Right? And I'd get up and I'd walk to the liquor store to get some booze right in the morning. Liquor store was just across the street. And I'd be walking down the street and I'd be talking to myself out loud. Okay, now this is 87, 88, right? Nobody had cell phones back then. Now if somebody's walking down the street and talking to themselves, it means something else, right? Back then, it meant a particular thing. You know, you noticed when people were walking down the street talking to themselves. And I remember standing at the corner of waiting for the cars to go by to cross to the liquor store, telling myself, the only way that I'm going to stop drinking is to jump out in front of one of these cars. Right? I had an awakening of a variety that a lot of people don't usually talk about. Right? I awoken to the fact that I had lost control of my life. And that all of the ideas and the plans that I had about not drinking I might not be able to pull that off. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, well, maybe I'm crazy. Had a lot of ideas of what might be the problem. So I went and I got a therapist to talk to me because I figured crazy people get therapists. Sat and I talked to him at $70 an hour, week after week. And on the way home, I'd pick up liquor, and it certainly didn't stop me from drinking. And he certainly didn't know a lot about alcohol, or what to do for me. And it's not because I think therapists are bad, and I just think some know more about the situation than others. Anything that brings me to some truth in my life has got to be good, right? But I couldn't see what was wrong with me. And I continued to drink like that. But the liquor stopped touching that part of me that it used to touch. See, I have this fracture in my spirit that caused this obsession for oblivion. Right? I still liked what liquor did for me. I liked the feeling it gave me. But it stopped touching that place deep down inside. I'm not one to say that it stopped working. I think it always worked. It just, once I realized that it had me and I didn't have it, the relationship started to change. Right? And my perception of that relationship. Because I continued to drink until 1989. Beginning of 1989. In the beginning of 1989, I remember looking around my life, thinking that it was completely hopeless, that there was nothing that was going to get me free from the way I was living. Nothing. And I went and I got a 357 Magnum, thinking this was my only solution to my problem. I knew nothing about 12-step programs. I knew nothing about rehabs. I knew nothing about sober livings. I knew nothing about any of that stuff. Jose knew stuff about it because he had been to a bunch, but he never talked to me about it because he didn't want to lose his drinking buddy. So the only thing I knew to do was pick up this 357 Magnum. And I figured that was going to end this thing that was going on inside that I absolutely didn't understand. Right? Because the alcoholic life took me to this place. I had a mind that wanted to die, but a body that wouldn't. Right? And there was a split second where I thought about it, because this 357 Magnum I had happened to be my brother's. He happened to have unloaded a shotgun on a friend of his and was on the run from the police. And I thought it wouldn't look good if his gun was used to shoot me. Right? And I was, you know, I was really, had a really good relationship with the brothers. And even though none of that really wasn't the issue, but it gave me a minute just to pause and look at what I was doing. You know, and I wouldn't say that I didn't want to die, and I wouldn't say that I was afraid, but just something blurted out of my mouth, and I wouldn't say that I wanted to pray, but what came out of my mouth was probably the closest thing I ever uttered that was like a prayer, and that was help. That's all I said. It was about as simple as words that could come out of my mouth. I looked up and I said, help. I don't know what I was looking up to. I wasn't giving it that much thought. Right? And I put the gun down, and I wouldn't say that from that day on I stopped drinking, because that wasn't the case. I continued to drink. I still couldn't stop. But what did happen was just a few days later, I bumped into a guy named Brian. Now, Brian was one of the guys, one of my friends from the gas station. Now, I don't know if you've probably had friends like this where you look at this guy and he says he's never going to make it to 18. That was Brian. Okay. Brian was almost like a cat with 9 lives. Brian pretty much stayed out of relationships. His first couple relationships in high school, both women died. Both of them killed themselves. And I think he was afraid to get into another relationship. And I'm sure it wasn't him that caused it, but he was a little tweaked over that. One of his best friends, they had stolen a little Triumph car, and it flipped over and he died. He had a couple friends that were really close to him die, and the girlfriends died. So all these people that got close to him died. So Brian was a little messed up, right? He thought that there was something wrong, really wrong with him. And Brian drank to oblivion. Like, you know, I told myself, if I ever got like Brian, I'd stop. Now, he's an alcoholic, and he's got a problem, but I can control it. That was my attitude. Anyway, Brian passed 18, and he hit 20, and he hit 21, and I don't know, he lost contact. And I was just walking down the street somewhere in Marina Del Rey, and somebody walked up to me and says, hey, Dan, how you doing? And I didn't even recognize this guy. He pulls up his sunglasses, and he says, it's Brian. His whole face had changed. See, Brian had gotten sober, got a whole year and a half. He was telling me about how he was in computer school now to learn how to fix computers, and how his whole life had changed. You know, and it's like, it was interesting because I connected at a level that I hadn't connected with all the other people that I had been talking to previously about the way I was living. Because I was lying to my family. I didn't want them to get in the way. My parents had passed away a long time before this, but my brothers didn't know the way I was living. You know, my wife didn't know the way I was living. My close friends, unless they were drinking with me, didn't know the way I was living. I was dishonest with everybody, even the therapist that I was paying $70 an hour to. I didn't want him to get in my way either. It's just, I got used to talking to him. But for some reason, I felt that Brian would understand and that I could talk to him honestly. Partly because I still in the back of my mind knew that he was much worse than me, obviously. But it was there was something different. I didn't understand it because his eyes were clear. He was like bright. He was, you know. And the more I talked to Brian, the more he kind of glowed. And it's like, you know, if you've been around for a while and you got a fish on the line, you know, a newcomer that's you know, is really interested, you know, you kind of wake up, you know. That's kind of, I realize now that that's kind of what happened to Brian. He saw he had a prospect in front of him, that, you know, and he was going to work me. And he knew just the right things to say and what not to say, you know. And I didn't understand it at the time, but I started to talk to Brian about what was going on with me. And it was the first honest discussions that I had ever had about my life and about the way I was drinking. So he started to talk to me about going to meetings. And I thought, meetings? Why would I want to do that? Right. I told him, I'm sure I'm not that bad yet that I need to go to meetings. That's what I told him. About 3 days later, I called him and started asking him about the meetings. You know, because I didn't stop drinking yet at that time. I was still drinking. And I saw that I really didn't know what was wrong with me. And I thought that I should at least give this meeting thing a chance. And that was helped a little bit. They say that this is a program of attraction, and I had a little twisted idea of what it really would attract me. And certainly the idea that there I'd get some help for what was going on in my life was interesting, but Jose said, you know, there's a lot of girls at these meetings. And I thought, well, you know, I spent a lot of time alone, and I kicked my wife out. Maybe I should check out these meetings. That was part of it. I wouldn't say that that was the only part of it, okay? But that was part of it. And Jose came with, and so it was me, Brian, Jose. We went to this meeting out in Pasadena. It was actually Brian's aftercare program meeting. Not aftercare, but he went through a rehab in Pasadena, and it was their meeting, alumni meeting. That was the word I was looking for. And I don't really remember the name of the speaker, but I do remember the speaker, and he was trying to be a comedian, and he used AA meetings for to practice on. And it was amusing, and I didn't get a lot out of it, but there was something about it. I couldn't say what, because he was talking about his drinking. And there was a room full of people they were talking about getting time, and some people were taking cakes, and I didn't understand really what was going on. But something was going on here I didn't understand, and it caught some part of me that wanted my life to change. And afterwards, about 50 people, maybe it was 30 people, I don't know, it was new. It was a lot of people went out to this 50s diner afterwards. And it was like, after spending so much time alone drinking, this was pretty overwhelming for me. So, but this fellowship and the laughter and these people that looked like they were having fun, I didn't understand it, but I knew that there was a part of my life I absolutely didn't want anymore. Because it was just a little while ago that I was ready to jump out a window. I remember there's a enclosed mall in Santa Monica, and it has a high parking structure. And I remember being at the top of the stairs looking down, and I remember thinking, this just before this meeting that I went to, and I remember thinking, if I just leaned over a little further, over the side, that this four stories would probably be enough to do the job. Because I couldn't go on living the way I was living. So this situation gave me a lot of hope. And I think hope is an important factor for someone who's new. I think if I would have walked into this meeting and they were all like crying about their day and talking about how sick they were, and I would have thought, I would have walked away thinking, those guys need a drink. I mean, but that's not what I heard. What I heard was people having fun. I was taken out to fellowship afterwards, and people were introducing themselves, and I thought, I always thought that there was no life without alcohol. I couldn't perceive that I could possibly live without it. But all these people are looking like they had a life without it. I didn't understand what they had or how they got it. But I think that there was a part of me that just surrendered to the idea that I needed something that's here. And I didn't know how I was going to get it. But I was going to go to another meeting. I think that was about as far as I thought ahead. I was just going to go to another meeting. And I guess I didn't know it looking back, but the biggest miracle that happened in my life ever happened that night. Because on February the 22nd of 1989, I absolutely could not stop drinking. Thought the only way I was going to stop drinking was to blow my brains out or jump out a window. And on February the 23rd of 1989, I went to my first meeting and never drank again. That was the biggest miracle that ever happened in my life. I hadn't worked a step yet, hadn't done anything, you know, but I came in touch with the first part of what I really needed, and that was to be struck with the idea that there's hope for me and that there's a solution here and that there's something here for me that will change my life. You know, and I hit Alcoholics Anonymous like a bug hitting a windshield. It just stuck right from the beginning. Right? And, I went through a period of time when I, just experimented with a lot of different meetings. Brian went to NA meetings more, and I found myself more comfortable in AA meetings. I don't know why, but there was a part of me that just was more attracted to them. And I don't know why, because most of the meetings that I'd gone to, they weren't really talking about alcohol anyway. I knew that anything that I was better than what I had, and I just made this commitment to just keep going. And I thought that there was all this stuff that I had to figure out. And I started asking a lot of questions. And it was interesting. When you start asking a lot of questions in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's interesting to find out how few people have any answers for you. Right? And some of the questions were as simple as, okay, you said find someone as a sponsor that has what you want. What does that mean? Right. I thought that meant you have to see, okay, what kind of car do they drive? What do they do for a living? What does the girl look like that's under their arm? And who are they hanging out with? Right. Who has pulled the things together around them to create the life around them that made them comfortable? That's what I thought finding someone who has what I want meant. And I went through about five of those in my first year because they never really lived up to my expectations. Right? I should say four of them at the beginning. Four of them. They were either too busy to give me enough time, that what I needed. You know, I needed a lot of their time, I thought. But Brian, who brought me into the program, told you what happened to him. He wasn't even interested in having a relationship with a girl, I think, at the time. He was driving a Volkswagen bus, and he did odd jobs like plumbing and still doing a little bit of the computer stuff. He actually just went back to what he knew, and that was plumbing. But he wasn't flashy, and he didn't have the stuff around him. But after all these other people with all this stuff around him failed to live up to my expectations of what I thought I needed to find, I ended up asking Brian to sponsor me. And, Brian sort of used the big book and sort of didn't. I had a lot of questions and still wasn't getting them answered. I was still trying to figure this out, and I didn't understand why I was so obsessed with trying to figure this out. And what I compare it to now, it's kind of like being not knowing how to swim and being so close to the edge, but not being able to reach the edge of the pool. Right? I'm in the pool, but I had nothing to hang on to. And I don't know how to swim. Right? in Alcoholics Anonymous, still dying, still can't get in the boat, the lifeboat that they talk about on, right, on page 16. Actually, they don't talk about a lifeboat, but they talk about something else, but we'll get to that later. Anyway, being so close to the solution, but not being able to find anybody that knew how to explain it to me. Not at least that made in a way that made sense. They talked about the God thing. That just made the hair in the back of my neck raise. You know what I mean? Think about it. How does a newcomer come in? Or at least, how did I come in? Wife's gone. Business is gone. Ready to jump out a window. And you're going to tell me that God cares about me. Right? So I didn't want to hear about all this God stuff. And you're telling me that this is a spiritual program. What does that mean? What does that mean? Right? And nobody could explain that. They just said, oh, don't worry about it. Just keep coming back. Right? You know, and you know, for someone like me, keep coming back to a place that isn't giving me any solution, it's tough. It's tough. It's really hard. Brian, too, also is not doing so good anymore. Brian started doing pain pills and then started doing a lot of pain pills and started doing so many that the doctors stopped giving them to him. Then he started getting them on the streets, and now I don't even know where Brian is. I've heard he's still alive, though. But he was doing fine when I was working with him, but we got to steps 10 and 11. And you know what his instructions were, 10 and 11? Was now you have to find an 11-step meeting or a 10 and 11 meeting. So his instruction was to go to find a meeting where they're going to talk about this stuff. And I never realized the thought that maybe Brian doesn't know how to give me instructions for 10 and 11. Right? I was his only sponsor. I was his only sponsee. And I never put this thing together because I really didn't know a lot about the program in my first year, obviously. I had about 7 months of sobriety. Still not understanding what the whole thing means and still not understanding why the thought of drinking still came to mind. I wasn't drinking, but the thought of drinking still came to my mind. And I just didn't understand all that. And everybody's still talking about this being a spiritual program. And, you know, what the heck does that mean? And right? I wasn't getting what I was hungry for something more. So what happened, though, was with Brian's last instruction is to find an 11-step meeting. I picked up a directory, and I thumbed. It happened to be a Tuesday. And I thumbed through the directory, and here it was, steps 10, 11, and 12. That was the name of the meeting. Figured, okay, that's what he told me to find, and it's tonight. I'm going. And that was at about 9 months of sobriety, and that was the Tuesday night meeting I mentioned in the beginning. It's still my home group today. Right? And it was, I had about 9 months of meetings now. I had some exposure to what a lot of different meetings look like. And this looked nothing like the other meetings. There was crosstalk at that meeting. And they asked each other questions, cutting questions. And they would have people speak, and and it was in the format that they had to answer. They were going to ask them questions, and, you know, but it sounded good in the format, but really what it looked like when you're there was interrogation. Because they would start to grill the speaker. They'd invite people down and then grill them as to what the big book says. And a lot of people didn't like that. But it touched something in me. I think partly I liked it because I was safe, because I was new, and I didn't know anything, so they left me alone. But what they said made sense. Right? What they said had an air of truth about it. You know, and when a question was posed to somebody in the group, they had an answer out of the big book that seemed to make sense and be logical. Right? And I'd never heard that anywhere else. And I came to see the benefit of a group that allows its members to ask questions. There was a lot of criticism as to how the questions were asked. Yes, sometimes there was a meditation before the meeting, at the beginning of the meeting, then a meditation at the end of the meeting, and sometimes the speaker would do his pitch and then they would grill him, and then the closing meditation would be about was 10 minutes, and you'd open your eyes and the speaker was gone. Because he'd never been to a meeting like that, and it probably would never probably come back. But there was other people that came in, and their responses to the questions were powerful. And I found that I started to be able to hang on to what they were saying as I was starting to see some truths about what this program is about. They weren't talking about this being about seeing my powerlessness. They were talking about this being seeing the powerlessness as my problem, but this is about getting power. Right? They had a lot of responses for most of the things that you generally hear in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. You hear a lot of people say things like, if you're here, you're in the right place. Right? Hear that all the time. Truth is, if I'm here, I'm in the wrong place. Right? Because I'm an alcoholic and I should be drinking. Right? And it's only by the grace of God that I've been given a gift of sobriety that's changed my whole life. And I have a responsibility for that gift, to keep that gift. Right? And it's got to do with how it affects the world around me. I have a responsibility for the message I carry, and a responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous, for the future of Alcoholics Anonymous, to know what the 12 steps are about. There's plenty of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that couldn't talk to you about the 12 steps. Right? Yet they'll tell you they're in a 12-step program. Right? Now, I can't tell anybody that they're staying happy and sober wrong. Right? And I think Alcoholics Anonymous has formed a really big net, and there's a meeting for everyone. I'm just glad that there's a meeting for some of those people that I don't want to hear what they have to say. Right? Because I went to plenty of meetings that resemble unsupervised group therapy. And I wasn't very attracted to unsupervised group therapy meetings. And some people don't like that term. You know, maybe you have a better one for it, but the thing that caught my eye and attracted me was a message that made sense. People that were talking about there's a lot to get here, and there's a simple, reproducible process that will get me there if I just do some simple things. Right? And that gave me even more hope now with some time. Right? It was another level of hope. And you know, I only had 9 months and saw another level of hope hearing that there's more that I could get. I just started helping someone with 21 years. And has just come to this process, and he's amazed that he's found a new level of hope, that there's more that he can get, right? Because hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous, not doing anything, year after year, it's easy to be at a place where you think, well, this is all there is for me, that there's no more here to get. And I've put the ceiling on my spiritual growth, saying this is all Alcoholics Anonymous is. So it's very, it's a great message to see that there's more for me, and that power, that and this process is infinite, and I can continue to grow. Right? And many people will go through the process over and over again because they've seen the results. And the people that went before me, right, that went through the steps more than once, who talk about getting more and different things each time they go through the process, right? They're the ones that encourage me to say that, to know that it's worth doing this again. You know, I've had plenty of people come up to me and says, Dan, you know, I think you only have to do the steps once. Then you live in 10, 11, and 12. You've heard that probably. You know what a great question for them is? Have you ever tried to do it a second time? Right? Because every time I've posed that question, the answer is no. I was just told I only do it once. My sponsor said I only have to do it once. So that's what I say. Because I can't tell you how many times I've worked with somebody and even people that have gone through the big book, and just going through it with another person, with another little twist, has taken a step beyond where they were. Again, because it's not me, and it's not necessarily only this program, but that power which we have access to is infinite. And I can open up to it at deeper and deeper levels if I'm willing to do the work. Willing to work the process. So, how much time do I have left? Is that? Okay. Well, I think what I'd like to do is stop here, actually. Because what this will lead us into in the morning would be to start talking about step one and my experience with that. And again, I said it earlier, and it's the idea that I knew I had a problem with drinking. Right? But the idea that I could never not have that problem on my own power, right? It didn't make sense to me. I believed that one day, even in sobriety, into my early sobriety, I thought that it was just about learning the right things to be able to control this thing. And, you know, the idea that, you know, that I needed a power greater than myself didn't make a lot of sense to me, because I didn't understand really the depth of that problem. I was told early on, if you're here, you've done the first step. I later found out that wasn't 100% true for me. Because in the back of my mind, I still had this idea that there's something I was going to learn here and figure out, and I was going to be able to keep myself sober. And it certainly couldn't have anything to do with this God thing. Because what has God ever done for me? Right? And with that attitude, I could not have had, you know, with the attitude that I don't need more power, that's just proof that I haven't really, really seen a good first step. Right? So, thanks, and I guess we'll pick up again in the morning. What time do we get back here in the morning? 9 o'clock? 6. Nine o'clock. Okay, and what time's breakfast? 8 o'clock is breakfast. 9 o'clock we start here. 7 a.m. there's an AA meeting. Okay. So 7 there's a meeting, 8 there's breakfast, 9 I'm back here. Okay. Thanks, and have a good night.